of the crop.
Hello and welcome to the 158th edition of the Gooner Podcast. This is your host, Kevin Witcher, speaking. And I've had a very busy day, which means I am on the wing, as it were. I'm just making this up as I go along tonight. However, we are recording towards the tail end of the international break on the Tuesday evening before Arsenal travel to Watford next weekend. And their last game, which I can't even remember now, was at home to Brighton and was a 2-0 victory, as I recall.
I'm glad you remember that.
Yes, it does seem like an eternity ago.
Gooners Anonymous.
Anyway, I'm going to have to do my panel intros off the cuff. So first of all, I'll start with our regular panellist, long-serving... what's your name these days? Hang on, it's Mustafa Goldstein, isn't it?
Yes. AKA, you can call me Basti.
As we normally do after about a minute. Anyway, Hampstead's finest. What was the last famous Arsenal player you saw wandering the streets of your neighbourhood?
Oh my God, you've thrown me there. I've been away for a month. I've been off writing a book, not about Arsenal. Oh God, did I call you and tell you? Because you probably remember then.
Was it Lehman or someone? I don't know.
Layman?
Obviously not. Okay, no. We're moving swiftly on.
If it comes back to me, I'll tell you, but I really can't think.
I went introduced our next guest, which is... I'm completely blank here. It's Tim. Tim Payton. Mr. PR for all the cricket. Do you do any other sports?
Cricket, horse racing, tennis, bit of rugby league.
Who do you represent for tennis?
Usually the governing bodies, the LTA.
Okay, all right. So he's a man who calms the waves of the various storms that crop up and is also a board member of the Arsenal Supporters Trust, far more relevant here. And we've got the AGM to look forward to in about 2.5 weeks. So I'm sure we will discuss...
More action when on the pitch at an AGM these days.
Indeed. It's going to be a good one. And finally, a very special guest. Been on once before, probably about 4 or 5 years ago. And quite significant that this guest is here because October 1987 saw the launch of the Gooner Fanzine, which is the reason this podcast exists. And in the early days, she used to be a contributor occasionally and has moved on to greater things, in all fairness. So, without further ado, it was just to introduce Amy Lawrence.
I'd say different, not necessarily greater.
Well, that's subjective judgment.
From the Gooner to football journalist to the year.
Pretty impressive.
Indeed. So anyway, let's start with current matters. And last time we gathered to record a podcast, Arsenal had just been defeated by Liverpool. We were in the middle of an international break and things weren't looking very good. Since then, we've had 7 matches. We've had 6 wins and a draw. How optimistic are you that we have turned this around and we're not going to see a repeat of the kind of disaster we saw at Anfield?
The word optimism is a good one, isn't it? I think we'll sort of be fair to middlingly all right and get some kind of... run together, which will then fall to bits at some point, and then all those big gaping great big gaps will come in again. It'll just be the same old.
Do you not convinced?
No, I'm very far from convinced that we're going to challenge for the Premiership or anything of any... Well, we can't challenge for the Champions League, can we? I really don't see us going the whole way in the is it called the UEFA Cup? No, the Europa Cup, the what's it cup, the sort of international meaningless cup.
I'm a big fan of the Europa League.
Yeah. Amy, a big fan.
I was in Belarus.
Some people are big Tottenham fans.
Isn't it a breath of fresh air? It's like football should be, in a way.
Well, yes, so if we get relegated...
It's like Arsenal's level at the moment.
Yeah, so if we get relegated to what used to be the fourth division and play Barnet, then that'll also be refreshing, and it will also be really nice and nostalgic, and God, that's what football's about, and isn't it nice? But we, as a, you know, Arsenal Football Club wants to be challenging at the top level, so... Yes, it's the worthless. It's to me, it's the sort of the milk cup of Europe.
I struggle with that because, and again, call me you talk about a sort of nostalgia for the good old days, and maybe I'm as bad as that as anybody could be. But Parma in 1994 remains one of the great Arsenal moments in my experience. And it's a European competition that actually doesn't even exist. It's that insignificant now. You know, people who are...
Well, they merged it, didn't they?
They more or less just jerked it off and said, you know, we'll rename the UEFA Cup and have two European competitions. And obviously there's that mimicking of the Champions League because they're both run on a league format, albeit the Europa League is so bloated. But I think that it's a pity, and in many ways, I see what you mean, the worthless cup, and people also turn their noses up at the League Cup. But again, for people of a certain age, Charlie Nicholas in 1987, that was a hugely significant Arsenal moment.
Oh, God,
that, without that, there is no Anfield 89. There is no winning the league in 91, losing only one game. It was the essential starting block in that period of time. It was the first crack at the mighty Liverpool, who for two decades were the powerhouse.
Don't get me wrong,
I'm not. Yeah. So I think you can, you know, we can sniff at these sort of so-called junior competitions.
Well, we've been spoiled,
or we can embrace them.
We've been spoilt for a period of time where we were fighting at the top level. So now to go down a little bit. And don't get me wrong, listen, I would punch the air when Charlie Nicholas scored, and I was there in 94 when Smudger scored, and it was just the greatest moment of my life, until we beat Real Madrid in a way. That was pretty good as well, although it was better than that.
See why it's got something for it, look at those Cologne fans who gave us, I think, one of the best games
we've had at that new stadium.
You know, for all the issues that happened, once it got going, it was electric, and but it meant something to them. Meant something to the home fans, and created it. And then equally, and I do think, you know, here we are, poor old Arsenal. Liverpool win a few games. When you go to somewhere like Belarus, I'm sure, Ames, you see these locals who get a chance to see Arsenal for the first time, and actually seasoned old people like me kind of fold the arms, come on and entertain us, and they're so excited to see their
teams. But those are teams we sing, who are you?
In some ways, it reminds to places like that reminds me that we're a club.
I've got to talk to Tottenham fans who are having a go at me about Thursday night, which we've done for the... Look, you're going on about Thursday night. Like, we were all sniffing at Thursday nights for 10 years, right? 20 years. So...
But we're talking
now
about...
we're here, of course, we deal with what we're given. It's like if you're on the dole, you're going to deal with it and say, well, it's all right being on the dole, isn't it?
You know, but hang on. The experience of being a football fan isn't always about worrying about the status of your club, which is a reason a lot of Arsenal fans who used to go to the Emirates...
Yeah, but you asked me the question... how are we going to do, first of all, right?
Yes.
Am I optimistic?
We've got off topic.
And I'm not. And yeah, we have. But I'm not optimistic we're even going to win the Europa Cup.
Right.
I'm not optimistic of that. I'm not optimistic we're going to win anything. That's not to say we won't. But
if we can have some fun trying.
Well, of course, we've got to have fun. Because, as Kev always tells me, and I'm sitting next to him freaking out and getting angry, he just says, look, it's just entertainment, Bass, chill out. You know what I mean? Because I'm freaking out, going, come on, for bloody hell's sake, Ramsey and whatever, right? And he's saying, Bass, calm down, give yourself a heart attack. You know what I mean? But that doesn't mean I don't want them to win, you know, obviously. But it is, yeah. You know, you've got to sort of drop a shoulder, haven't you, these days, I suppose.
Amy, are you seeing on the pitch signs that Arsenal are going to do better than they did last season?
Not particularly, in the sense that you talk about, you know, there is something very familiar about this pattern of, an unbelievably shameful banana skin in front of everybody where you just, you know, you get up blushing, wishing that the floor would open you up. That's what Arsenal did at Liverpool. And then, you know, putting on a brave face, dusting themselves down and getting on with it and putting a decent run together. We've seen that. You know, repeated within each season for each of the last 10 seasons or so at various points. It's a common kind of...
I know you're a journalist and you're objective. And you have close links with the people who are at the club. But as a supporter, and you'd still have a season ticket, I believe.
I do, yes.
Do you feel like it's time to have a different kind of season?
Yeah, I think you're probably right, and I think that was the root. That entire question was the complete crux of the whole Arsene Wenger debate. Mm. You know, do you want
almost
to feel
bored
different?
Of seeing
and
the same
I definitely
old thing.
Feel a lot of people that I spoke to, obviously not people within the club who can't say such things, but you know, just out and about, people who are connected to Arsenal, who care about Arsenal. It was an overwhelming feeling I felt towards the latter stages of the will he, won't he dilemma of the latest contract renewal, where just people were saying almost, I don't care because people obviously care, but I don't care so much if it's still a bit rubbish and terribly disappointing at times. I just want it to feel different. Mm. And there is this, you know, this is something that we all spend far too much time thinking about, you know, disproportionate to what really probably matters in each of our little lives. And it means the world to everyone who puts a stake in the club and puts their colours on that mast and says, I'm Arsenal. If that's how you feel, you want to have hope, number one. You've got to have hope. And when Bastley turns around and says, you know, I'm not particularly optimistic that we're going to win anything, that's quite a difficult thing for a football fan to have, because I think essentially every football fan has to have some semblance of thinking we might win today, even if you're on a 10 match losing streak or whatever it was that poor Leighton Orient went through recently where he couldn't win forever. Or you know, you have to feel this time it could be different,
otherwise you'd never go.
Exactly. And it's too masochistic.
Well, it's like watching Wales yesterday, and it was funny, it was odd, because I was finding myself supporting Wales because Ramsey's playing, right? So I'm sort of going all Ramsey, right? And every time
he
kicked the ball up,
5 seconds ago.
No, but it's like watching Arsenal. It was like watching Arsenal. I found myself getting nervous and irritated because Ireland parked the bus. Wales were going left and right and then just couldn't get through. And it was just like watching Arsenal again. There was no kind of, you know, you remember the days of obviously, you know, Henri and Bergkamp and all that. And we just sliced them up. You know, we could just do things that would just slice them up. And we have players who you think are capable of that. But something's not gelling there.
Well,
something's,
I think, when you look at the great Arsenal teams, that, you know, you mentioned those players. And when you think back to those times, what was so exceptional about it is you had these fabulous individuals, but they were able to channel their genius into the team. And I think you can, when you watch current Arsenal, you get flashes. You know, there are moments in games or, you know, moments in different periods of time where a player or a little move or whatever it is can take your breath away. Arsenal still have that. But the difficulty is sustaining it, and the difficulty is creating this thing that's bigger than everybody's individual moments. And I think that's what Arsenal have really found the trick that they can't crack, and that's the difference between competing for the, you know, the massive trophies, Champions League and Premier League or what have you, and, you know, let's not forget winning 3 FA Cups out of 4 in the last few years. And you say you're not optimistic, but if Arsenal could win the FA Cup 3 years out of 4, there's no reason why they can't win one of those cups, be it FA Cup, League Cup or Europa League, this year also.
But as a fan, I was still more optimistic watching, say, Merson and Parler and Hillier, I'm probably, you know, the 94 team, for example, you know.
Yes, but that was a team where everybody understood their jobs.
Yeah, you know? And also you overlay nostalgia onto that and where we were at the time in reality.
I still felt more optimistic
now.
I felt more, well, actually, on the way to Parma,
I still our favourites to win the Europa League.
We have to wait and see who drops down. Exactly. And we're the highest. Can you make that?
But because we're in it and who you can put there and the seedings, but the quality of that squad and who comes down. I've got winning the FA Cup and winning the Europa League are very within Arsenal's attainment this year, and if it all clicked they could go higher. I mean, none of us believe it will click under the current manager, but if we changed manager and that manager delivers us third or fourth place in an FA Cup, I think that would be seen as success against resources. Partly it's this year after year of appearing to see the same then a fault's come up, and I'm so with Amy, and sometimes I feel bad when I think this, which I think I just want to hear a manager give different excuses in post-match conference. I just want to see a different way of tackling it. We'll probably come third or fourth because that's about where the par is for our budget, but this sense of Groundhog Day under the same manager, people have become weary of it. And Liverpool just, it feels like the same cycle on repeat, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Terrible performance. You think that dressing room has lost, it's not playing for him. And then they'll come out with 8 wins in a row.
But it's that thing where I just think you look at the team and you think, you know, go up north and don't be scared to one of the big teams. Like, where is this?
But they did then do that at Chelsea. They then did that at Chelsea a bit. I felt they went there and they weren't scared and they played much more tough and resilient, which is kind of the equivalent game. What you mean is when they go to the big club.
So I suppose the test, going back to Kevin's original question, is, you know, the only way that cynics like us are going to move from that point of saying, well, we're not optimistic, or you're not expecting anything to be different because the pattern's the same and the same, is to take that Chelsea performance, and never mind these ones that have come around it against the teams that you'd like to hope that Arsenal will probably get results against, and see what happens at the next biggie.
It's City, City away, Spurs home in about a month.
That'll nail the rest of the season.
What worries me a bit about Arsenal is that when you've got the ball at the back, a kind of very almost slow motion, sheepish. There's not a sort of, you know, we get the ball and there's a kind of timidity. You know, we don't seem to be ruthless and quick and angry. You know, I've been in Spain for a month, so I've been watching Real Madrid and Barcelona on telly and stuff. And, you know, they get the ball, and it's like, first time, boom, 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 let's go. And we've got the ball, and it's like, I'm not so... I'll control it a bit first, and shall I pass it to him? No, I'm going to go over here. You know, it just seems hesitant, and there's a lot of vacillation within individuals there. It doesn't seem...
I think if there's one thing that has excited me above all else about this little mini run that's followed Liverpool, it's Jack Wilshere.
Yeah.
And exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. He doesn't care, he goes. Yeah.
Is what he is capable of bringing. We all know that that's a delicate conundrum, and we just, you know, we have to hope that that turns out in a positive way. But I think there have been moments where, you know, when you watch Arsenal's midfield, it's easily the department of the team that can look quite dysfunctional. You know, finding that right blend, it's probably been about 18 months where it feels like Arsenal's been trying different combinations to see what might work, what might not work. You know, Coquelin and Ramsey, and then Ramsey and Elneny, and then, you know, Xhaka and this one and that one. And really, on the whole, none of them as a combination have been massively convincing. And I think that's where, when you talk about the defending, and, you know, defences will look up and they'll want to play it to a Vieira or a Petit or a Gilberto Silva or a Fabregas. Mm. And unfortunately, that Arsenal at the moment don't have too many of that quality in centre midfield.
Well, missing Cazorla in that respect.
But exactly, with Cazorla out the team and with Wilshere out the team for the long term, it's been really difficult to try and find a solution that's fantastic. So, naively, I pin some hope on Jack actually making the kind of comeback that lasts.
So does Gareth Southgate. Well, so England need him just as much, don't they? But maybe even
players
more.
Players of his vision are not commonplace.
Yeah, it was very strange to see him back, because I actually thought, oh well, that's the last we'll see of Jack Wilshere, because when, you know, it was, you know,
well, they player offloaded him anywhere this summer, wouldn't they, if they could have?
But then he's such a good player, and he's when he's, you know, he's got this low centre of gravity, he sort of pushes forward, he's not scared to have a go. And if I look at players, I mean, I don't feel convinced about Xhaka and Elneny at all in their kind of, you know, they're just, it's almost as though they've got a mistake waiting to happen vibe going about them. Whereas Jack, you just feel like he'll you know, give the ball a run, create a triangle, move into a speed and put a cross in, you know, he'll have a go Jack, whatever. But we need a bit more of that, a bit more cut and thrust, I think, a bit more daring. Daring do is the word.
Jack was big mates with Wojciech Szczęsny, and I get the feeling that some of their japes and some of their approach to being a member of the Arsenal squad didn't always fit with what Arsene looks for in a professional. Do you think there's an element whereby Jack has already burnt his bridges there, or is there a chance he might actually be encouraged to sign a new deal?
I think fate might have intervened here. As Tim said, there was every chance that he was going to go this summer. At various points over the last couple of years, I think it could have been, you know, the end of that relationship. But fate has brought him back and created an opening, and if he, I mean, we wait for him to play against the highest calibre opponents. It's been probably the perfect situation for him. He's been coming into games against teams who are not quite of the absolute elite in terms of the challenge. So to go to Bate Borisov, or to have a run out against Doncaster Rovers, or you know, even some of the games where he's come on against, he's played against a little bit against Brighton and West Brom. I can't remember all the games, but they, you know, there's been space for him, and he hasn't been under too much physical pressure. I think that it's a great opportunity for him to, that this could be the springboard, but he's got to just take that next level and show that he can perform at the highest level and dominate games against the toughest opposition who won't give him a second. It's great to find, to look up and find a, pick a beautiful pass when you've got space and time.
And what may also work for him is clearly Ozil isn't signing another contract, and actually, you know, the manager can be, I think the not playing of Ozil in recent games is a little bit more than just a bit of an injury. I think there's a kind of, that's almost like a tacit agreement. He gets a week off at Christmas, doesn't he, here and there, and I think he got his bit of time off. But I do think that opens up this opportunity, you know, for Jack Wilshere. It's going to be very interesting watching the next 3 months, and we've all got to kind of cross fingers for him, because of course it's the injury issue of when he plays two tough games in a week and really has to mix it against, you know, against one of the tough midfields, and does he stand up to it? But there's so much talent in there if they can just get him firing.
Well, there is, but there's also that little bit of kind of gazziness about him in the off field, you know. Can he keep, because I mean that whole kind of being caught with a cigarette going out, obviously clubbing then and doing that kind of stuff, you know, is he maturing as a person who's going to sort of, you know, fit into the Arsene's regime of well behaved.
Look, I think
Amy knows as well. Lots of players are up to that kind of thing.
Well, Arsene won't worry at all as long as he's performing on the pitch.
Arsene Wenger, you know, loved Ray Parlour.
Yeah.
Who was never an angel in terms of his off the field behaviour.
Because of what he brought to the team.
Exactly. So I think Arsene is quite good at being able to be flexible with his principles if the player were. I mean, you know, there have recently been a couple of stories aired that, you know, some people are annoyed with Sanchez and Ozil getting sort of preferential treatment. And really, since they've been at the club, they have had privileges that others don't get, or certainly don't get so freely. So I think that, you know, Arsene knows what he has to do to try and juggle all the balls. But it, you know, it's sometimes he'll turn on someone and say, "Right, I'm not having that from you," and that's the end of that particular situation. But others he can be more flexible with. So be interesting. I think it's down to Jack to make sure that he's in the half of the sort of Wengometer, like where I am with people, that he will cut him some slack.
Okay, well, I do like to mention our listeners who submit topics and questions. Joe Gagliardi asked about the Europa League. He asked, so far has the Europa League experience been better or worse than you expected? Well, we've sort of covered that, but there is one little side issue which I think is worth raising, which is we're seeing a few young players in European competition, not just the League Cup. Who's excited you this season?
I mean, I went into the season with massive expectations about Reece Nelson, because seen him a little bit with various youth teams.
What is his natural position?
He's one of those, he's a classic Wenger, kind of can play anywhere along that attacky midfield zone.
So why is he playing him as a right wing back?
I think two reasons. I think one is to try and instil some discipline. Mm-hmm. And the, you know, almost in that sense of, even with a young Thierry Henry, saying, here, you go and play wide, even though he thinks he's a centre forward, to just try and build in some kind of different work ethic or some different understanding of the job, or a different skill set that, you know, you can then bring to your natural position. So I think that's part of it. And there is also some kind of seniority at play. So if you're picking a League Cup team or whatever, and Theo Walcott's around, he's going to get first dibs on the attacking role, even though you might think, well, actually, let's let Reece Nelson loose where he's going to do damage. With the young players, the really fascinating thing always is getting them to translate their natural ability that they're showing in the younger age groups on the big stage because they're so fearful of making mistakes. It's a really, really fine line. Am I going to, you know, try something, give the ball away and it costs us a goal and then I might never get picked again? That, like, I think they have a real pressure that they have to overcome when they're out there picked for the first few times between how much can I show what I'm going to do or should I just be a bit safety first and just make sure I don't drop a massive bollock somewhere. And I think that they've been, you know, it's taken Reece Nelson maybe a couple of games where he's been a bit more cautious, and I think the more games he gets, the more you'll see him trying the kind of special things that he can do.
Do we have any hopes for Ainsley Maitland-Niles, or you think he's...
I think he's playing in a really, really difficult position for, you know, for him at left wing back. That's completely alien to him. He's much more of a central midfield player. And I think that, again, he'll have benefited massively from the job that he's been asked to do. And Wenger likes him because he's played him, you know, over a number of years now, giving him little bits and pieces. And the other one, of course, is Joe Willock, who has forced his way in really since the summer. I think he had a couple of bits of football and was around the first team in pre-season. And, some, you know, Wenger does that sometimes. He sees someone in pre-season and he's seeing them every day and he's seeing them with and against the big guns. And that's when he thinks, okay, you've got something I want to work with. And I know he was very taken with Joe Willock over the summer, wanted to give him a chance. And
is he better than his brother?
He's completely different. His brother is a much more attacking player, much more fancy footwork, and Joe is much more of a kind of box to box. He's got, you know, a different kind of stamina, different involvement in the game, tackles, more of a kind of midfield defensive orientated player.
Okay.
It's just fun to be watching and talking about new players, and I do want to give credit to Arsenal as well, because they've set pricing for both of those competitions at the level that matches the team, but is kind of, you know, balances it out. And, you know, £5 for kids, £10 for adults to go to the League Cup stuff. They reset the pricing for the Europa League. It's kind of C-minus in terms of category. I think £15 and £25, depending on what you are. What about, and it's exciting. It's the right price for that kind of thing. But I would say to Arsenal fans, come along and watch some of these youngsters. They play their heart out. It's great. It's an affordable price. The away fans are excited to be there as well. And in some cases, I think when Bart Bowers on, it might be a bit empty. And I think the whole experience, particularly of Europa League, seeing these new players, fans from different countries, what it's all about, it's really given me a kind of new enthusiasm for him.
It's always nice to see a new young face come on and do well. You know, there's something really special about it. There always has. I remember Parler's first game. I remember, you know, like lots of young players over the years, and you really want them to do well. And I also find them easier to forgive than I do the ones who are there for every...
Well, of course. You know, and also, because you know they're a young kid and they're not, like, a prima donna on 250k who's prevaricating about whether to sign or not. Yeah. And that's why I also say, on the one hand, we can spend ages agonising about Sanchez and Ozil going, what will happen? But it'll always be 11, you know, players prepared to put on the Arsenal shirt and get out there. And kind of we're seeing that now. It's... You know, the king is dead, long live the king, isn't it? And this year, what do people want to talk about? These youngsters, much more interesting than watching, you know, whether or not Ozil's putting in a shift or not.
Well, I think in one sense, it's the Europa Cup is a really good thing for us because it is a good rebuilding tool. And it's a chance for young players like that to get some real, like, international experience, you know. All that, you know, just going abroad and stuff for some of them, you know. I mean,
to play football in Europe beyond February,
exactly.
Maybe,
and you know, I mean, it's an even more it's a tougher test than maybe playing in the
League Cup. Stick to it.
That's had so many names. I don't know what to call it.
Call
anymore,
it the League Cup.
All this corporate cup, the corporate cup.
It's a high energy. Drink from time.
Yeah, I thought it was an insurance company before I found out.
I don't even know what it's called.
It's the Red Bull of Thailand.
Is that what it is?
Okay. Anyway, that provides us with an almost seamless link talking about youngsters, because I'm relating this now to Ajax and stories about Mark Overmars coming to Arsenal. Now, Mark Overmars, as I understand it, is the... And I haven't read any of this, I've been told about it. Is the director of football at Ajax. And the suggestion that he might be coming to the club would kind of go against Arsene's pronouncement that he wouldn't work under a director of football. Amy, a bit of me thinks Arsene has always had this philosophy that he wants to leave Arsenal in the best possible state when he departs. And yet, the structure at the club isn't comparable with other top European sides who have some kind of strategy and specific personnel to basically ensure that on the playing side, the staffing is in a particular way, transfer targets are identified, etc., etc. So I'm thinking of teams like Chelsea, Manchester City, Bayern Munich, Barcelona. Could Marc Overmars or any other comparable figure roll up at Arsenal while Arsene is still there? Or is it a matter of we don't change until Arsene does depart?
Well, I think there is a sort of semantic way around this. If somebody like Marc Overmars or whoever this mystery person might be comes in who is called something other than a director of football, then the club get away with trying to bring in somebody else with some football contacts and experience, an executive sort of position, and Arsene gets to continue his stance that he won't work with or under or alongside a
director. People aren't going to be pulled, though, are they?
Yeah, but the other factor that enables this slightly is the moving on of Dick Law. I mean, there's been some changes at executive level, not nearly enough for my liking, but you know there is essentially a vacancy there. There obviously was a vacancy in the head of youth development for a little while, which has been temporarily filled until Per Mertesacker takes over. There is sort of strange staffing issues that are a bit complicated, you know, with the scouting department, who quite is in charge of what, with the contracts, who quite is in charge of what, with it's a bit messy. And actually it would benefit enormously from somebody coming in probably above the whole lot of them, or and overseeing how, you know, who's doing what, perhaps not as efficiently as they should be, and sorting it out, or getting people in who are more able than some of the people who are coasting, and changing things and shaking it up a bit. Club needs that. I don't think Marc Overmars is going to be the man that does that. I don't think that will happen until or if ever there's a change in ownership. So we kind of muddle on.
However, why do you say that? The change in ownership. What's the significance?
I think that
because of the relationship between Stan and Arsene.
No, well, partly, but also because from what we've learned of Stan Kroenke's ownership style, which is pretty hands off. You know, you don't get the impression he's phoning up, you know, five times a week to his man inside the club and getting the lowdown on everything and studying all the detail of, never mind on the pitch, but off the pitch detail. What, you know, what's going on with the promotions? Why are certain sponsors not renewing? Who's coming in instead?
What was the Daily Mail about when I'm shaving, looking in the mirror, and I see the get a winning team kind of strap like that? Every day I got up and I thought, get a winning team.
Yeah.
That's not at all like that with Kroenke.
It's a completely different It's a completely different strategy that's going on at the club. And so if somebody does ever appear and there's a change, which means that somebody comes in and says, right, we're going to have a root and branch look at this club and what everybody's doing. There's 800 members of staff or whatever the hell it is. It's a lot of people in a lot of different departments, and how many of them are performing to their best?
Is it Arsenal Football Club or Arsenal Property Estate Agent Development?
I mean,
on the football side, it might be a small. It's actually a very small business. You know, it's a huge wage bill of £200 million, but £190 million of that goes through 20 people. You know, maybe it's about 20 people.
Well, everything's
not
connected.
Very big.
It's connected, but
the commercial is now connected to the football.
Well, only in my impression of the results talking. In the football drives the commercial. It's a different set of team. The person desperately wants to be director of football is Ivan Gazidis. Mm. That's what he really, really wants. You know, office in the training ground. You know, sitting on the UEFA committee. No, but he really, you know, watch him try and fill that role the minute that but Arsene goes, and perhaps have a junior there. I've got one key thing to say here. I think getting the executive right, sharpening it up, is all spot on. But Arsenal have one fundamental missing now, or real fundamental, and that's that they don't get the elbows out and they've not got links to the super agents, if it's Zihavi, Mendes, or there's four of them, the other two. And it's a real rough, dirty, hold-your-nose world out there. Mm. But if you don't work with those super agents, you don't get the super players. And yeah, it's kind of horrible they're taking £15 million cut out of a transfer. They own these players and decide who's going where. But so, you know, when Arsenal do rock up through Dick Law or Ivan Gazidis, they're miles out of that kind of level. We've never signed a player from there.
And it's not...
They don't want... You know, they don't want to be, partly because of Arsenal's view. And this idea that there's almost a morality not being there, well, unfortunately, then don't kind of run a football club, because it's not church, it's fairly grubby in the undergrowth of how it all works, but that's where we are. And that is, I mean, I don't say, you know, people sometimes think that I talk too much about what David Dean offered, and you wouldn't bring David Dean back now, but it was somebody like that, a bit wheeler-dealer-ish, someone prepared to say, yeah, we'll pay you £15 million over the odds and you get £10 million of it, because we can afford it, the money's in the bank, and Arsenal will be stronger. Mm. And they've got to address that. Because you look at the big transfers going now, the really big players are getting monopolised by these super agents, and if you don't scratch the super agent's back, you don't get the player.
Yeah, we've never replaced the schmoozing of David Dean. That, you know, he
had, well, that's one word for it.
He had the ability to go out there and in that marketplace and you know, look it's very simple. Look at Arsenal pre-David, Dean and without.
The contrast is David Dean had the authority to seal a deal. From every anecdote I've heard, Dick Law cannot do that because he isn't allowed to.
There's two things. There's the reporting line to be swift and decisive when the option comes up, which kind of takes you back to the Arsene thing, but there's also the way the game's moved on, and you've got to be hanging out on the yacht or talking, you know, in with Mendes and scratching his ego, or providing him with a player for something he needs in return to come back. So there's two kind of key things missing at the moment: decisiveness and the contacts. And I don't think that, although Mark Overmars might be interesting, that's kind of almost like a technical appointment now. We have to address how we're going to get back among those 8 or 10 super clubs that are dealing with the super agents.
Well, I have it on good authority that the guy who's been mooted as coming from Barcelona will be coming. So watch that space. Someone sent me an email link and I checked it out. It's the guy who deals with Barcelona's transfers for the last 10 years.
Right.
He's there, kind of David Dean stroke Soriani, whatever it is.
Doesn't fancy living in an independent Catalonia then.
Apparently there's a lot of shake up going on at Barcelona in the football club.
Well, there's a lot of shake up going
not
on,
only speak, yeah. in the society, and he will be moving on. So I think he's been bollocked for not signing Coutinho, apparently. But big buddy of Gazidis, so he may be arriving. Okay, just to name check Simon Albert there for the Mark Overmars discussion. Let's look forward to the AGM briefly. We've had Rocky the King. He's asking if Ujmanov sells up to Kroenke and goes to Everton, what scorched earth policy do the panel think will save our club from being asset stripped? Well, I think that's more of a comment than a question, but fair enough. It seems Ujmanov is not going to allow Kroenke to take the club private. I think we pretty much agree that's a good thing. I don't think there's that much to discuss, but what do we think is going to happen at the AGM, Tim?
At the AGM, there will be more challenge and aims towards Stan Kroenke.
Mm. Do you think he will actually be forced to respond, or...?
Well, we're at the Arsenal Supporters Trust is actually surveying members at the moment on a few issues around ownership, but one of them is to ask them if they think that Stan Kroenke, you know, should address the meeting, should kind of have the courtesy to talk to supporters and shareholders and follow up on commitments he made at the time of takeover. I'm sure that the membership survey will say they think that's right, and we will write in advance and request that he does speak at the AGM. I'm not sure if I expect much, but we kind of have to do the right thing of asking and expecting. It sort of comes back to what was being talked about a few minutes ago. Where is the direction, sense of purpose for your football club if a guy who owns 60% won't deign to give a few words of passion or encouragement or sense of purpose at the annual general meeting, one of the only three or four times he comes into the country? But that's what we'll try for. We are, you know, we've been in regular dialogue with Usmanov, and actually we were in dialogue last week, which prompted the statement, which was encouraging, because him holding on to that 30% is important in that it still keeps the club kind of plural. It allows a few of us to hang on to the shares. There'd be no AGM. There'd be no AGM if he sold out, because he'd take the club private. We wouldn't see the report and accounts. So that little bit of scrutiny we get, and one area, as people sometimes say, what difference do you make? Well, at the last couple of AGMs, those who were there will know there was incredible kind of scepticism and challenge around the £3 million payment. And that's gone. And actually, because he just did say it went partly because it felt like the hassle of what it was creating wasn't worth the reaction it was getting. So there's an illustration of, in a little way, hopefully, where you can sometimes make some difference. But remember that every resolution at the AGM, every decision about how the club is run, we can all put our hands up and vote one way. He's got 67%, so he wins and, you know, he controls the club.
Yes, it's more an opportunity to make a point.
It's not a power play anymore, it's a protest play.
Yes, exactly. Mm. Do you, just in your own view, do you think if Kroenke did take the club private, was able to, that he would leverage the club?
It's really hard to say. It must be likely. I think the first reason he'd do it, and the much more important reason, well, he wouldn't have to fly in and face us a lot. He could list it in Delaware, in the States, which is where you've got the very light corporate, you know, responsibilities. You wouldn't know what was going on with management fees going up or not. You know, 5, 10, 15, 20 million a year could start being removed and be very difficult to tell. It would be a further retrograde step to the concept of the club being something custodian and being something where we know what's going on.
Mm. Okay. Well, I think my mind's just thinking Herbert Chapman would be rolling in his grave at all this kind of, you know, just that the way that the club's gone with under Kroenke. I mean, is there a chance of us or someone somehow, what would it take?
About £2 billion.
For someone to, for him to, you know, vamos.
I don't think it's possible. I think he's committed to it for the long term. What he bought, I met him a couple of times at the beginning and he was quite clear. He bought media rights. Sport is media rights, that's where it makes its value. And he knew that the American properties don't sell across the globe like Premier League football. And actually, he's been spot on. When he bought in, Arsenal were earning about £120 million a year in total broadcast rights. We've just seen it go past £270 million a year, and the tenders are going out next month for the next contract, and it will get bigger. The only time I saw him get excited in discussion was when he said, wait till Africa gets broadband, Tim, because that's, you know, buying the subscriptions. And there's still so much growth to go in English football, particularly in the overseas markets, actually, because I'm not sure how much more you can squeeze the English market with
financial
money.
Growth.
But when the middle class in Asia and the middle class in Africa start affording football subscriptions and watching our game, which they do, and that's, you know, it's an investment in media rights. Mm. Yeah, and the time will come, this is what I really shudder about, but the time will come when Arsenal will play a league game in Kuala Lumpur, you know, or Dubai or Minneapolis, because he owns the property and it will be globalised. So I really don't think that he's going to go. And the statement of that as well, he's put his son on the board. That's, you know, it's a long term hold in the Kroenke family.
But does everything have its price?
Well, yes, it does, but I'm not sure now where you find the person that's got, you know, 2.5, 3 billion or whatever it is to persuade him to move on. It's an extraordinary amount of money. There has been
I'm not even sure if I'd call them a consortium. I don't know. Amy probably knows better than me, but a bunch of wealthy Arsenal fans who've been looking at it. But actually, if they got hold of the club, they'd have to take huge debt themselves to have to be able to buy it. And then you might worry about how they serviced that or where it went. It's unbelievable amounts of money. You mean, you know, David Dean basically bought Arsenal for, what, £265,000 in the 80s, and now it would take £2 billion. I don't really see the way out. Unless, slightly flippant comment here, but, you know, unless Jeremy Corbyn gets in and nationalises them and hands them back to us.
Love it. There's always a solution.
Maybe I've got an idea there.
He is an Arsenal fan. And he's got the Cazorla chant, so, yes, I like that, I hope.
I don't know what...
I'll cling to that one.
Amy, you were writing about that this week, this sense of it's almost like beyond us now, we just have to watch it happening.
Yeah, I think that sort of sense of helplessness is quite frustrating, and certainly for those of us of a certain age who, you know, remember... I mean, I've found some old letters at home. God knows what kind of garbage I was inflicting on people involved in football when I was a teenager.
The DKM Friar.
But pretty much, I've got a series of letters on Arsenal-headed paper from either Ken Friar or David Dean or George Graham or, you know, about anything and everything. Responses to whatever I was complaining about. But if these were people that you could, as an ordinary punter who had absolutely no rights whatsoever except the £3 in your pocket that got you into the North Bank or whatever it was, could either write to and be guaranteed a response back, sometimes, you know, two or three pages of proper argument. I had some. Do you remember when QPR were going to merge with Reading?
Yes.
Sorry, very off topic, people out there, apologies. And I wrote some long letters that I think David Dean was involved in
Thames Valley
to get
Rangers
that,
or something.
And complaining about it. And I had about a 2.5-page letter back about it. You know, and obviously you could see them out and about in Avenel Road if you hung about after the game and going in or out of the marble halls or the car park at the JVC Centre, and
they went away. They went
people,
away,
of course. Or you'd see them on the
well,
train or whatever it might be.
Club then,
and now you think there's this guy in America who doesn't give the impression that he's too bothered about any of us or what we think or our
he's
club.
He's an investor, not a supporter.
Of course, and that's his right.
Well, I remember when we did the Arsenal rap back in the time, and I wanted to get it onto, I wanted to get it into merchandising, so I contacted, I think his name was John Hazelwood or something, wrote him a letter, and I said, they said, oh yeah, that sounds good, and they liked it, and it was all going along, and then the last minute they went no, and then there was this sudden kind of possibility of me being actually sued or something, you know, and for passing off or whatever. But then I wrote them this letter, you know, I've suffered the depths of depression and the heights of euphoria since I was six. I wrote my Arsenal CV to them, and, you know, they came back and it was Sounds Magazine or NME did a thing on it, said, kindly, Arsenal have decided to drop
they didn't stop it though.
No, they didn't. It stayed independent. Yes.
Okay.
Sold a couple of thousand copies, so
all right. I've got one somewhere.
No, I wouldn't listen to
with
it.
With all my
and all your letters.
It was very homemade, let's put it that way.
Right, well, it's sort of, we're going to move on to a bit more nostalgia in a way. Alan Thompson emailed. He said, with the printed Guna coming to an end, which I will mention shortly, that may not be the case.
Ooh.
Well, yes.
Oh, you've done the old trick, haven't you?
Right.
Breaking news!
It will depend on the reader's commitment, as I'll explain. But anyway, Alan Thompson asked, do any of the panel remember buying copies from Sports Pages London?
Yes,
absolutely.
And on a similar vein, when did you stop buying, or at least enjoying, the official programme? Nope. So it sort of leads to a wider discussion, which is, do fanzines have a place anymore in the current exchange of supporter opinion?
Yes.
You think they do?
And they're there. They're there as blogs. They're there as podcasts. They're there. It's just a different format.
Right.
What we're doing now,
okay,
is just because we can, because you can record it and put it on the net. The reason that I'm picking up, so people know that it had to be the Guna 20 years ago, because it was the only way we could communicate with each other.
Well, I think, when the fanzine came out and in its early and really successful years, it was an either or. It was a very straight decision. You were either official, buying your merchandise from the club shop, but buying your programme off a programme seller and doing things that way, or you were buying the fanzines, you were buying some dodgy T-shirt or badge from a bloke outside, and that was how, if you were that side of the fence, that was how you communicated, was through the fanzine. And I vividly remember waiting for the next one to come out quite eagerly, because that was your source. That was your connection to people who felt like you, if you weren't just going down the official paths of, traditional journalism. You might get a match report in whatever paper you maybe read. There was the odd radio programme, but there was so little media, never mind social media. Even mainstream media was really minimalist when you go back to the late 80s when the fanzine culture first started to evolve. And fanzine culture came about because there were young people who felt something that was going on, who weren't going with the flow, who wanted to rally and rebel a little bit and have a laugh along the way and find something a bit anarchic and be able to express themselves and commune with other like-minded people.
Well, it came out of punk. Actually,
exactly.
Well, this is it. It was a sort of little cult thing, wasn't it? It was sort of like cult football, kind of grassrootsy, bit dirty. I mean, that's like, well, do all my little records I used to do as well. It was like I could see you doing the Gooner, and I thought, oh right, well, why don't we do some little, indie songs and stuff, and like stand on, and that's a bit of street culture. That obviously old Highbury. The streets were, there was a vibrance around the streets, and there was a real kind of the walk up to the stadium was not as important as being in it, but there was certainly a kind of aperitif happening there, and I used to walk around the whole ground sometimes, just look at all the stalls and do all that sort of stuff, and I think I remember there was a definite point where it was like, well, I don't need to buy the programme anymore, because the Gooner actually served the purpose. I didn't believe anything that was in the programme. It's all gone a bit stale. There were the times when those programmes in the 70s, and you had, Brian Kidd at Home or something like that, and the sort of players in these sort of like, wearing Tesco trousers in front of the fireplace with their family, And I used to sort of get the programme for that when I was a kid, and then obviously who's playing and all that sort of stuff,
but you needed your vouchers as well.
Well, no, there were the vouchers, of course. That was important.
And for information,
final vouchers.
Now you need information. You just get your phone out. But back then, it was the only way of having information when you went into the game.
Because we have social media now and all these different platforms, it's you can get that all those same vibes electronically, in a millisecond. But of course, so somebody made the point, and I thought it was a really, really good one, was when you look at that comparison, is that a fanzine had an editor. Social media has no editor. So, where people can quite quickly slip into, being really foul to one another or overstepping lines that one shouldn't overstep if you're going to be civil. I think at least with fanzine culture, there was, people recognised that you're not absolutely revolting to one another, and you try and see the lighter side of things, even if you've got a point that you want to make.
And once it's on printed matter, you're not going to be able to change it. So if you're going to write something that's going to be printed, you're going to make damn sure that you really mean it, and it's your facts are in place and everything, and it's in. Well, I mean, let's put it this way: I like to triple filter everything I write for the Village Voice and make sure that it get that it's. I've read, I've really been careful before I put it out a little bit. Whereas I think people, when they're online, it's sort of like blurted out sometimes, and it's not really, you don't sort of self-control already.
There isn't that filter that people will say things to you that they'd never say to your face if you were discussing it in the pub or there. Of course, it kind of anonymises it.
But it felt important because it was real, and it was something you could buy and look at and go over and over again. And I definitely remember being totally wowed when I first started to buy the Gooner, just thinking, this is fantastic. And then taking about, I don't know, however many months or whatever it was, to pluck up the courage to, to write something, because immediately there was this connection. This is my kind of thing. These are my people. This is where you want to be. And they were, in those early days, there was always a little like, the fanzines for everyone, everybody. If you've got something to say, write it, send it in. And I thought,
that is still the policy, actually.
I know, but it was. It felt quite...
Yeah, I know.
You know, because being published was a big deal back then. Yeah. Now anybody can self-publish.
Yes.
But back then, it was like actually seeing something that you've done.
Well, that was that.
Massive.
And it was that by the fans, for the fans thing as well. So it was that in a way, it was like an alternative voice that, you know, it's not the club, which... You know, sort of. I remember I was sitting in the, not that long ago, and they were lying about the attendance figure, and some bloke coming out and saying, "And Tractor Productions up 40%." You know, and I just thought, oh, you know, there was a little bit of us, and there's always been a bit of us and them going on between the club and the fans as well. You know, and I remember it back in the 80s. You know, and. You know, people going on about the board this and the sort of grumblings in the North Bank.
Well, I remember a certain Amy Lawrence being dragged off the North Bank in 1992.
Where it was four policemen.
What? Oh, come on, Frank.
No.
Come on, we want the autobiography.
Time is getting on. Our special guest has to depart. I will just say this briefly about the Gooner. We've had a look at it, and I've actually realised that it is becoming a niche publication. And if people want the thing to continue beyond this season, basically there'll be less sales on match days and more commitment from the readers to pay for it in advance, season by season. The details I will work out exactly in November, but once I've done that, it's down to the readers to decide whether or not they want to actually commit and keep it going. And if they don't, it's fine, because my thing about printed matter now, and Amy may be able to relate to this in her own job, it's difficult to maintain on the pre-existing model. You've got to adapt, and that's what we're going to try and do. Anyway, I am very grateful to Amy for coming, and I do know she has to rush off, so I'm going to conclude things here. I will just name check Mr. Lancaster, who raised several topics we did cover in other questions. Thanks for that. Other than that, just to say that the current issue of the Gooner is on sale at home matches up until Huddersfield, when the next one comes out. This is our 30th anniversary special. It's got a Tony Adams interview, plenty of nostalgia, columnists and articles about the current matters. So yeah, pick one up, £3 from our sellers outside the stadium, home and away. Apart from that, if you want to get in touch with us, you can email us goonerpodcast@gmail.com or tweet us at goonerpodcast, and we will be back in, I think, about the second Tuesday of November for our next one. However, with that, it is many thanks to the panel. Thank you to Bestie.
Thank you.
Tim.
Thank you.
And of course, our special guest, Amy.
Thanks.
And with that, this is goodbye from your host, Kevin Witcher, and we'll be back in a month's time. Thank you for listening. La-di-da-di-da, la-di-da-di-dee, all good friends and jolly good company. Well, hey!